This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe on Tuesday delivered his first State of the State address. He mapped out his priorities for the year, and that includes changing the way the state funds K-12 education, eliminating the state income tax, and returning the St. Louis Police Department to state control. Yesterday morning, STLPR political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum and State House and politics reporter Sarah Kellogg sat down with Governor Kehoe in his office at the state capitol for a wide-ranging interview. Here's Sarah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Governor Kehoe, for kind of the first interview or your first state of the state. And so let's get started and with what you consider to be one of your biggest priorities, which is public safety. Why do you think that having a gubernatorial board overseeing the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department would make the city safer than the current oversight setup?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. Again, it's great to be with you guys. Public safety is near and dear to my heart. And as you know, the St. Louis region has had, or the St. Louis city area has had, the local control for a little over 10 years now. And I believe the model works better when you have a little bit more of an influence from somebody who's very sensitive to what law enforcement needs. And the current law enforcement group of folks in St. Louis believe that they're not getting the priorities and getting paid attention to enough. They're down 350 officers in St. Louis, and that's a real problem when you talk about solving crime. And I believe we need somebody who's more sensitive to what the men and ladies in blue need in the St. Louis region, and I think a state-controlled board can provide that.
What would the board do differently that can't be done now?
Well, just appointing different people on there that would be helpful to making sure the process of, number one, becoming a St. Louis City police officer. Now, just if you talk to some of them, when they go through the process of somebody who's just interested in being an officer, it can take weeks, maybe months, to get that processing through. We know other departments are getting this to happen in a matter of days. So there's a lot of things that we can do to, we believe, help the department from a budget standpoint, from a appointment of getting more officers on board, and then just paying attention and prioritizing crime and getting crime under control in the St. Louis region. I think we can be helpful with that.
St. Louis Mayor Tashara Jones and other city leaders have contended that this idea is a solution in search of a problem, pointing out recently that police officers in St. Louis have received significant salary increases and that in Kansas City, the state control model hasn't resulted in a reduction in crime. What would you say to that?
Well, two things. For one, I'll start with the second piece first. In Kansas City, they had a $41 million decrease in the police budget there. I don't care who's under control. When you have that big of a budget decrease, it's going to be a problem. And number two, in St. Louis, the barometer that I'm watching, the data that I'm watching, is will businesses feel safe enough for their employees and their customers to invest in St. Louis? And until the business community, which is a lot of politicians aren't listening to, and it's not just in St. Louis, it's on both sides of the state, until the business community says, this area is safe and I'm going to invest capital in it and I'm going to build my business there, that's the piece of information we need to be following.
All the people sponsoring the bills taking away mayoral control, State Representative Brad Crist, Senator Travis Fitzwater, and Senator Nick Schroer, none of them are from the city of St. Louis. What would you say that this is another example of Republican state government trying to micromanage the Democratic St. Louis region?
I would say I'm from the city of St. Louis, born and raised. So I know St. Louis like the back of my hand. And those are great representatives and senators who are willing to carry the issue, that understand what the region's issues are, and they know it's one of my big priorities.
Do you have to be the one to appoint the members, or could it be a situation where maybe the Board of Aldermen picks someone, the police unions pick some folks? I'm curious if it has to be kind of your prerogative.
Well, it's a process, right? And so it's going through the building now, and I think there'll be people who have some different ideas on what this all might look like. I'm open to working with folks as long as we get good representation for the men and ladies who walk the streets and are members of the St. Louis City Police Department now, and they're good with it, I'll be good with it.
I want to talk about immigration for a moment. Recently, State Senator David Gregory of Chesterfield testified in support of his bill that includes life imprisonment for those found guilty of being in Missouri illegally and a bounty of $1,000 for reporting people without legal status in the United States. What do you think of this idea?
Well, in general, illegal immigration has plagued our country and our state. You've heard me say it many, many times that fentanyl deaths are at an all-time high in between ages of 18 and 45, including in Missouri. Much of that fentanyl, I wouldn't say all, but much of that fentanyl is coming across our borders. Criminal activity that's coming across the border is significant, and there'll be multiple plans. Again, that's Senator Gregory's idea, and as it works through this building, I'm sure there'll be various pieces of that that may or may not end up being in the final bill should it get to our desk. So we'll watch what that happens. But things that we can do to control immigration, the citizens of the state are very much ready to find a way to make our community safer, and that's one of it.
Even if Gregory's bill doesn't end up passing, what would you say to the contention that these types of ideas are stoking unnecessary fear and panic among immigrant communities, even people who are in the country legally?
Well, I would say to the folks that are here legally, just like our relatives did in the late 1800s, that they're here legally and they don't have anything to worry about that.
But there have been instances already since the Trump administration of people who have been detained by ICE who are legal citizens. And so do you think legislation like this could cause that situation where someone just looks like they're not here legally and then they are detained or reported by their neighbors?
Yeah, you've heard ICE use the term, I believe they use collateral damage. Sometimes they might be going after somebody who they know is here illegally and inadvertently catch a few of the other folks. But I think the process will work through where the people who are here legally will be able to continue to go on and be members of our community and productive to our state.
Moving on to taxes, you announced that you want to start seriously studying phasing out Missouri's income tax. The billion-dollar question is, how do you do that without basic services falling off a cliff in Missouri?
Well, you know, look what we've done so far. In the last 5 years, we've cut our income tax from 6% to 4.7%, and we've still funded essential services, some at record levels, including education. So there's a responsible way to do that. I've said all along that as we work to eliminate our state's income tax, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to need some time to responsibly phase it in so that we do take care of essential things in the budget, public safety, education, et cetera. And so there's a lot of plans moving through the legislature. There's a lot of people have some ideas on how to do that. We're going to pay very close attention to that and try to work towards that. At the end of the day, I believe that Missourians can spend their money better than elected officials any day of the week, including me. And so that's a good place for us to be at. It's a key to economic development, by the way. When we're talking to these companies about expanding or moving to Missouri, and they're looking at other states, whether it's Tennessee, Florida, Texas, et cetera, and their opening statement in those states is, if you move to our state, we have no income tax. When we get there to that table to talk to that business, it's pretty hard to overcome that. And so we need to get a tool out there that gives us that economic development tool to bring more businesses here and expand our economy.
I'm glad you brought up other states. One of the things that comes to mind is a state like Texas has a massive oil industry that can make up for the fact that it doesn't have an income tax. Florida has a massive tourism industry to make up for the fact that it doesn't have an income tax. Nevada has gambling, which, if that's your thing, it's not mine. But what sort of thing does Missouri have that could generate a similar replacement mechanism?
Well, I mean, I think if you follow Tennessee, has a pretty good model. If you want to look at a state that's outside of the parameters of specific industries, Jason, that you just pointed out, there's some things we can learn from Tennessee. And again, there's multiple different plans moving through the legislature, and the conversation of how we do this, I think, is critical. I've asked the Department of Revenue, as you know, I mentioned yesterday, to bring the best minds together to start looking at this, to come up with a problem that come up with a solution to this problem that doesn't cut essential services, that also puts more money back in Missourians' pockets. And if you don't start with the conversation, try to start throwing things on the wall and see what sticks, it will never happen. So that's what our goal is.
Revenue projections for the next fiscal year are down. So how do you kind of reconcile that with we're not getting as much money with or with decreasing the amount of money the state would be taking in?
Yeah, our revenue predictions were based on the previous administration. I do believe the current administration, Washington, D.C., will do a much better job of getting our economy going again. Inflation was just killing Missourians and Missouri families for the last 4 years. The price of anything they bought, from milk to a 2x4, was, you know, sometimes double or triple. And as the Trump administration administration gets inflation under control, continues to get our economy moving, I think revenues for at least for our state will continue to grow, and we'll adapt with that.
I do want to touch on your plan for state worker pay increases for a moment. This specifically aims to help people who have served in state government for a long time. So if somebody who's been here for 20 years, I think they could get a 10% pay increase. The problem I see, though, is if you're hired for a really difficult job last year, your salary is going to remain the same. I'm going to give an example after this question. Can you address that point? Because if I was hired to a state governmental job that was really challenging at $40,000 a year, and my salary is still going to be $40,000 a year, I may be looking for another job.
Well, and I know the specific job that you're talking about that you'll bring up in the next question. We've talked about it before. It's a critical piece for us. But, you know, you have to look at what we've done up to this point under the previous administration and under, you know, previous legislature. In the last 5 or 6 years, if you add all the pay increases together, it's almost 20%. So it's not enough because the private sector market, you and I have talked about this, moves faster than government does. But we heard from our cabinet members, and we quite frankly heard from a lot of state employees, that retention is a big thing for us. That turnover, that 20% of turnover that you heard me talk about that's happening in a lot of state departments. We haven't had, in the last several years, we've had pay plan increases, but we haven't done anything to address retention. And we believe this tool will help us reward state employees that have been here a little while, not just necessarily 20 years, but somebody who's been here 6 years or 8 years or 10 years. We think that this is a tool that will help us. And again, the legislature's going to look at that, and they're going to see if they think that's a significant piece.
The agency you were correctly predicting I was going to bring up is Children's Division.
Yes.
We had talked before about how the starting salaries for child abuse investigators is $44,000 a year. That's not going to change unless somebody has been here for a long amount of time, as we just mentioned. But you told me that it would be worthwhile to raise that starting salary, and it's not in the budget. Why not?
We're working on a process there. I mean, it's just something you got to remember, that the budget that we start working on, a lot of it was, you know, developed already by the time we won office. So there's some things that we're working with the legislature that might not be in what you see today that could be in the future.
This comes as Senate President Pro Tem Cindy O'Loughlin declared that the Children's Division needs a complete reboot. She told me that right after I talked with you a couple days after the election. And a number of child welfare advocates have told me that combines like a new accountability structure to make sure that Children's Division workers are actually doing what they're meant to do, combined with higher salaries. Do you have any initial ideas for how you would want to see that agency restructured, with the caveat that you need to appoint a new Children's Division director before you do that?
Well, Jessica Bax, who will be the lead on that, Health and Human Services, is a great person. We're very excited that she's come on board. And we've talked to somebody we think will be a great candidate for that. Senator O'Loughlin will be very much involved in that conversation. And I would say more to come on what that division looks like, who the director is going to be. And I think you'll see some very exciting outside-of-the-box things come from that.
That's Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe talking with STLPR Sarah Kellogg and Jason Rosenbaum. We'll get to more of their conversation after this short break. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. Let's return to Jason Rosenbaum and Sarah Kellogg's conversation with Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe. Kehoe, on Tuesday, delivered his first State of the State address. Here's Sarah.
During your speech, you said that you wanted to rewrite the state's foundation formula. How do you do this without setting off a hornet's nest of opposition between different types of school districts, as was the case in 2005?
Look, it's going to be a hornet's nest because I was not here in 2005 when they wrote the last formula, but I know a lot of people who were, and I've talked to them about it. And it's a tough, that's a tough thing. But as I tell legislators all the time, Missourians didn't send us here to be comfortable. They have sent us here to actually work. That formula is 20 years old. and it is not doing what it was designed to do 20 years ago. The world has changed. The way we educate children has changed. Technology has changed. We learned a lot of things from COVID and what that does to the learning environment. There's multiple pieces to that puzzle that we need to fix to reward the schools that are really putting out a good product and then get the schools who are struggling to come up with a plan that we can help them with so they can get a better product than when those men and ladies come out of those schools.
And as you mentioned in your speech, you're not fully funding the foundation formula with your budget. And though it is a record amount of money, it's still not what was asked for. And this prompted a lot of criticism from Democrats who felt that this was part of the promise of passing the massive education bill from last year. Can you explain your reasoning on that?
With the $200 million we put in is what 727 would have required, which is the Senate bill that was passed last year. It is almost triple the average of what the funding formula has received. I believe the highest it's ever received was 120 some million. So we have significantly funded public education. And I'll tell my friends in a public education area all the time, if they're unhappy with that, I got another number and it has no decimals in it. They have to understand that this is a triple of what their normal average is. And for somebody to come to me, a small business guy, saying, you're cutting us or something, I'm like, that is the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life, when you're getting triple what you would normally get from the average.
With 727, which is, again, that omnibus education bill passed last year, would there ever be a situation where the revenues coming in just wouldn't be able to sustain the demands of that bill? Because it had a very hefty price tag on it.
It did have a hefty price tag. And remember, a lot of that, and that's what you're seeing, the $200 million, a lot of that went to public education. So it was a good bill for public education and for school choice folks. This state and this legislature and previous legislatures have always figured out a way to appropriately fund education, and I don't see that changing.
You've suggested placing $50 million of state money into the education savings account programs, and this was touted as a tax credit to donors of private scholarships. Wouldn't this be an expansion of the idea that the state directly funding private schools?
Yeah, I mean, the ESA program, I've been a big fan of that. I've always said I'm a big fan of it. We think it's appropriate to put general revenue in there. We learned from some states when Senator Koenig actually was handling that bill or pieces of that bill that ran into problems in other states where general revenue was court challenged, to be quite honest with you. We believe this is an appropriate use of funds. And I, again, in the education arena, it's not different than the business arena. A rising tide raises all ships. Competition is good in anything you do, whether it's education or business, and it makes everybody else perform at a better level. And that's what we want to do in Missouri. We want our education systems that are high performers to stay there, and the folks who need a little bit of help to have an incentive to perform better.
You mentioned during your speech that this administration will be built on merit, and we will not support DEI programs in state government. DEI stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion. How would you define what a DEI program in state government is?
Well, sometimes DEI has created kind of a false sense of why somebody, or our quotas on why somebody should be promoted or whatever, you know, different opportunities in state government. And as you heard me say, I started out the speech talking about the first female Senate pro tem of the Senate in Cindy O'Loughlin, the first Asian American and speaker in John Patterson, the first person born in St. Louis City raised by a single mother and me. We got here working hard on our own merit. And that's what I want, a level playing field for people who want to work hard no matter what their background is, no matter what their skin color is, no matter where they came from. If they work hard, we want to have the flexibility to be able to reward them, and that's what I want. That's the environment I'd like to see created in state government.
I spent a lot of time talking about this issue with former Department of Social Services Director Robert Nodell, and he mentioned to me there is value in teaching his DSS employees about communities they serve. Like, there's a Congolese community in Kirksville, for instance, and there's the Amish. There's obviously the Latino community and African American communities. Would banning DEI programs make it harder to do that specific type of training to state employees?
No, I don't think so. Huge Ukrainian communities in Springfield and Sedalia that I've talked to about this. You're right. We've got a great diverse state of people that we've welcomed to come into the state the appropriate way, the legal way, that are great, productive Americans and Missourians. And no, I don't believe that this will interfere with what they need to do and how we need to work with those communities to make them continue to be part of our culture. pressure. Remember, when we started the state 203 years ago, we didn't have a DEI program, and everybody that moved here was from somewhere else, right? And so and we became the state that we are, and it's a great state.
I definitely remember that because I'm 204 years old.
Yeah, well, I'm probably a little older than you are, Jason, but...
You're 219 years old?
Yeah, probably. Continue, about Sarah. Right.
A number of legislators have put forth some ideas to repeal or replace Amendment 3, which enshrined protections for abortion rights in the state constitution. Very few of them have a window where someone could get an abortion for any reason. And even President Donald Trump has said that the six-week abortion limit in Florida was too short. You know, is there an idea for someone to get an abortion within an 8 to 12 week time period? Do you think something like that has a chance of passing?
Yeah, you know, look, Senator Hawley, President Trump, and myself, we've all said that we protect innocent life, that we will do anything we can to speak for the unborn, but we believe there's some reasonable exceptions that might work. And that's been the president's position, Senator Hawley's position, and my position. My number one priority is to protect and be able to speak for innocent life. I mentioned that yesterday. I mentioned working with our pregnancy resource centers. I think they give a great alternative. And there's multiple ideas that will be working through the legislature, and we'll see which one of those are constitutionally valid that would work for Missourians. And if it works to protect innocent life, then that I'll be in favor of it.
The fact that you didn't spend a lot of time in your speech saying, I want the legislature to put this on the 2026 ballot, and you focused on the pregnancy resource centers. I don't want to try to say that I'm a mind reader, but it does seem like you inferred that that may be a 2026 legislative issue rather than a 2025 legislative issue.
Yeah, the legislature is going to work through when they think the best timing is for that, and if they can get the votes to pass it. And as you know, the referendums don't come through the governor's office, so that will be something that they'll have to decide what works best. And whatever we can do to protect innocent life, it will be a question before Missourians, to your point, Jason. So we'll be in favor of something that works constitutionally, that continues to protect innocent life.
On the topic of maybe modifying or changing Amendment 3, you know, Missouri is a Republican state right now, elected Republican statewide on very large margins. But it's also true that Missourians passed Amendment 3. And I think that it's naive to assume that everybody who voted for Amendment 3 who are Republican did it because they didn't know what the amendment was. And so my question is, how do you combine a consensus with maybe curtailing or limiting Amendment 3 with getting something that voters will pass?
Well, you've got to remember, Amendment 3, it passed, but it wasn't a, you know, overwhelming. I would say it marginally passed. And, you know, you had $32 million of out-of-state money spent to pass that initiative against a very small amount in the other column. So whenever you have that type of resources behind you, I think it's easier to pass, you know, in any state, including this one, almost anything that might not be exactly what people think it is. I would argue that I talked to a lot of people who voted for Amendment 3, and they weren't sure exactly what it was. There was some confusion there. And that's why I think it didn't pass overwhelmingly.
You know, something in your speech that you didn't mention were the Chiefs and the Royals stadium subsidies in your speech. And I am going to say this is a Jason Rosenbaum question. Does that mean that you support letting Kansas bankrupt itself to lure the teams here?
Well, I did mention it. In our economic development part of the speech, we talked about working with businesses, retail, manufacturing, and sports teams. And so we have, Governor Parson worked very hard with the ownership group of both the Royals and the Chiefs. We will continue those conversations. We will work with our legislators. And look, I've said all along, these two sports teams, it's an economic development question to me. It's no different than a widget manufacturer. If they were in Kansas City and they wanted to move to some other state and they employed a lot of people and they had a big impact on our state's economy, we'd be working very hard with local leaders to figure out a way to keep that business in Missouri. We need to work very hard to keep the Chiefs and Royals in Missouri, but it has to be a good return on investment for Missourians. It can't just be a dump truck load of cash. I'm not for that. The business plan has to work, and we believe we'll continue to work on that with the ownership groups and try to do something that's responsible that keeps those teams where they belong.
You've been governor for, you know, a week plus, two couple weeks now. How has that been? What are the surprises so far?
It's humbling every day to walk in this office. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Obviously, with Governor Parson and previous governors, I mean, policy-wise, I didn't probably get along perfectly with Jay Nixon, but I would consider him a friend, and I worked with him in this office many times, former Governor Blunt, et cetera. But now walking into this office as governor, it's really a pinch-me moment every time I walk in. So it's still... It's still a pretty humbling experience, and my wife and I very much are appreciative that Missourians put us in here, and we feel very blessed to be in this position and have an opportunity to lead Missouri for the next 4 years.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Governor Kehoe, for joining us.
Thank you guys for being here.
That's Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe talking with STLPR State House and politics reporter Sarah Kellogg and politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Kehoe delivered his first State of the State address on Tuesday and sat down with Jason and Sarah yesterday in his office at the state capitol in Jefferson City. Joining us now with a bit of context and analysis is Jason Rosenbaum. Jason, I understand that Governor Kehoe only did one media interview yesterday, and it was with you and Sarah. What is it that stood out to you from what he said to you?
One of the things that I noticed, especially in retrospect when I was walking away from the interview, is his command of policy is really strong. That's not a value judgment on whether his policy declarations are good or bad, but he does a pretty effective job at making the case about why he wants something, like whether it be a state board for the St. Louis Police Department or paring down the income tax or the foundation formula. I don't think you really have to dig deep to figure out like what he believes, because it's very obvious. And I think that may even be a little bit different than Governor Parson, who I think was a bit more general and could be kind of vague on things like what is workforce development anyways.
Mm-hmm. I mean, generally speaking, Jason, when something doesn't become law in Missouri, it's because Republicans disagree with one another, because there is a GOP supermajority in both the House and the Senate. And even though Kehoe may be very clear on policy and what it is he wants, are there any issues that might breed conflict this session?
Maybe not this session, but I think that redoing the foundation formula for K through 12 schools is going to, as he said, unleash a hornet's nest of regional opposition. Changing that formula could have a major impact on how suburban and rural schools operate. And I think that could be an example of Republicans not agreeing. Even though I think Republicans do want to pare down or get rid of the income tax, I do think that there are members of the House and Senate who are realistic that doing that without finding another funding source will devastate basic services. So that may not be a 2025 conflict, but it could be a conflict later on in this governorship.
So it sounds like that is something that you'll be watching for. Is there anything else that you will be keeping an eye on it and following in the coming weeks?
As you probably noticed, I talked a lot about the Children's Division and the funding. So I'm definitely going to be watching to see if the legislature decides to provide a bigger boost for starting pay, especially for child abuse investigators. And I also am going to watch if the board that oversees the St. Louis Police Department ends up not being appointed by the governor, but maybe by local officials. Mm-hmm. I think that could be a compromise there that maybe not everybody is happy with, but it eventually achieves the goal that Kehoe is trying to put forward, which is having a different oversight mechanism over that law enforcement agency.
Jason Rosenbaum is STLPR politics correspondent. Jason, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Today's episode was produced by Sarah Kellogg and Jason Rosenbaum. Recording and editing by our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
Podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.